What's going on, Sarge? Thanks for doing this, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah,
Hey,
thanks for
thanks for
coming
having
on.
me. Thanks for having me.
Happy New Year's, man.
Happy New Year, Merry Christmas, and all that stuff.
20 years with the NYPD, so I'm sure a large majority of them were at details, Times Square. Give me your first New Year retired. What'd you do? And what'd you do 2 days ago for New Year's? Anything good?
Not really. Okay, so I did. I think I did the parade, the New Year's Eve festival there about 7 times out of the 20. So I did pretty good. Some of them in the beginning, and then once you get promoted, you start right back at the bottom, and you're right back out there. And then when I was in cold case, they scooped us up for that too, because they never thought we did anything, so they sent us for that too.
And how about
So
this year? You do anything this year?
I spent it with my folks. We traveled down. They live in Delaware, so my wife and I went down there, and we spent the holiday with with them. So it's been pretty good to see them for a couple of days.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up on Long Island. I was born in Brooklyn and transported immediately out to Nassau County. My dad was an auto mechanic, and he was working in Brooklyn at the time, and then he got a job out in Suffolk County, and he moved us all out there. So I didn't spend any time in New York City as a kid, but I grew up on Long Island. We grew up in Levittown, and I went to the parochial school over there. I went to St. James, and then high school I went to St. Anthony's. And then
Oh, wow.
college, I went to Nassau Community College my first 2 years, and then Hofstra the last two.
And normal childhood, or was there a moment like good guy, bad guy, where you decide to serve and protect the people of New York? A defining moment, or you always want to be a cop, cop or bust?
No, it wasn't. My godfather was a fireman, and he was pretty high up on the food chain up there in FDNY. And growing up around him, he only lived down the block, and he kind of influenced me a lot towards the civil service thing. So I think my parents would have bet the house that I would have been a fireman. But when the time came, because we're talking 1990, I took the test. There wasn't any fire department tests. So my dad was like, "What? Just take the police test." I said, "All right, that sounds good too." So I took the police test, and it was one of those quick ones because if you remember, there's a little history behind it there. They started with the Safe Street, Safe City. Under Dinkins. And so I took the test in June of 90, and by June of 92, I was hired. So, I mean, it was bang, bang. I mean, now they're just, it's just like it's like a lottery. You want it? You got it. Good. You're in. But, for as a young kid, I think I was 21 when I took the test. So I got on a little bit later than some. I was like 22 and change, almost 23, which I think is a good year, but it wasn't my first job, and I try to tell students, because I teach at John Jay College, as you know, and I always tell students, try not to make policing your first job, right? Make sure you have a couple of jobs ahead of time, because I think it's important that you understand, the nuances behind policing. And I also tell the kids too, even if you have a job that has customer service, those are skills as a cop that you're going to need. So, I always encourage people to do that stuff. We all ran into people that this is their first job, right? And this is the first time they're ever dealing with the public, and the first time, and that could lead to problems.
92, you come on, like you said. Where were you assigned when you come out of the academy?
When I got out of the academy, I was assigned to the 4-7 precinct up in the Bronx. I lived on Long Island, so then I was paying a toll on top of that, so I was getting double whammy, right? So, and the Bronx was something that I never really visited, right? I mean, we're talking 80s and 90s and stuff. You didn't say, "Hey, let's go to the Bronx and see what's going on." I still think today people don't say, "Hey, let's go to the Bronx and see what's going on," unless you're going to Yankee Stadium, right? Long Island is their extent of knowledge of the Bronx are two things: one, Yankee Stadium, and two, anything above the Bronx is upstate New York. That's basically what Long Islanders think about the Bronx.
Was it, give me a first night, not a first night, give me a night on a foot post or a really crappy arrest when you're like, really, this is what I signed up for. The NYPD should be busting down doors. Give me something silly, like, what am I doing? 23-year-old kid. And I bet you, your friends in Long Island, like, oh my God, Joe's fighting crime. He's this big, and well, give me a
Yeah.
horrible night.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, when we got out in January. So, and you're a rookie cop, and if you remember back then, I mean, you didn't get a car. You were on an FTU, right? The field training unit. We had 30 people in my FTU in the 4-7 precinct, and we had three squads, and we worked the day shift and the night shift, and we were doing the 5-2, 5-3 split because there were so many of us. So we weren't getting like weekends off or nothing like that. So we got thrown right into it. And in the middle of January, here I am standing on White Plains Road, at 228th Street, and everybody's selling drugs all around me. I don't know what the hell's going on. And they were having a good old time. And it takes a while till you realize exactly what they're doing. But I remember some nights being frozen out there.
Joe, did you get the Medal of Valor in the 4-7?
Yes. At the time, if you remember, it was called the Medal of Merit. They changed all that stuff after. Actually, there was a whole big thing about a whole big hoopla about the fraternal orders there doing that. That was actually my medal day that happened. And wow, what a wow. scene! But yeah, so I was involved in a shooting. I didn't shoot anybody. None of us got hurt. But we went for a nearly 6-minute gun battle between my partner, who was not my normal partner. It was a Saturday, and we got a call for a disorderly group of youths in a warehouse, and we walked into an armed robbery where they were taking hostages, and the gunfight ensued. I had, and remember, I had 38 too, so here we are. No talk about outmanned and outgunned, but like everything else, they were younger guys, and they kind of froze up a little bit, and they didn't charge us, but when you go to your training, right, cover and conceal, and when we walked in, there was this huge bay door, because it was a Cablevision warehouse set. So they had the big warehouse doors where they were, you could drive the trucks in. So it was a sunny day. So when we walked in, we were silhouetted. We didn't know what was going on. And you know how you walk in from the sun into the dark,
yeah.
it takes a couple seconds for your eyes. And so when we walked in, I didn't see it at first, but about 5 or 10 feet inside, there's this guy holding a gun, wrapping the guy up. And I'm like, hey, and he turned around. I'll never forget. He turned around and phew, he took a shot at me, and I was like, oh, did this guy just like shoot at me? Because it's not like television, right? So where things, so you just kind of like, so we instinctively, there was a Cablevision van right to our left, and we dove behind that for cover, and then we exchanged shots until the cavalry could arrive. We were fortunate, and they had, I think it was 7 hostages. Everybody came out okay, including us, and they did too, right? But they went to jail. A couple of them got 20 years because it wasn't their first offense, I think, if I remember correctly.
Wow.
And then there was one guy was a kid. He was like 16 or 17 years old. He was stealing Cablevision boxes at the time. That's how, they were going to sell it, and that was the whole deal.
Wow. It's funny that when you get promoted too, you get like an eighth of a point for the Medal of Valor, but you get a full point for fitness, you're on the promotion list.
Yeah, I can tell you the Medal for Merit and all that other stuff, and 275 will get you a ride on the subway.
Yeah,
nobody cares. It's like everything else that you do. The public doesn't understand. The cops don't care. You don't care. It's just you just go there to do your job, and I was fortunate to survive without getting hurt, and that's the only thing that really mattered, because I only had, I think, 2 years on the job when it happened. And, one thing I always tell people, if you're going to study things, like officer-involved shootings, they seem to happen within like the first 5 years. And you look at it, very rarely do we have, veterans do it, unless, of course, they're in like an anti-crime unit or something like that, where they're actively going after guns. But I think the normal cop who in New York City, I bet you'd find out within the first 5 to 7 years.
Is it because they're on patrol, you think? Or like if you're older, you're more likely to be –
not get involved.
Yeah. And that's what I like about your book. That's what I like about your book. You at the end of every chapter, you suggest research, things to research. I'm in the master's program at John Jay.
Oh, cool.
And I was the one who you can thank. Mike can thank me for suggesting you. You're one of the guys. You and Eugene O'Donnell were really.
Gene's great guy.
That's why I decided to apply. And I won't have you in class because I only have 2 classes left, so I'm not like trying to get an A. But but you Mackie Haberfeld, who I had the pleasure of having as a professor, was great, and you three were really.
Oh, that's great! Yeah, no, I mean, listen, yeah, Gene was instrumental in helping me get started with many of the interviews and stuff that I get involved with.
Wow,
he's good. He was doing a lot. Yeah, he was doing a lot, and. And he kind of approached me and he said, hey, you ever think about doing this kind of stuff? And I really didn't think of it at the time, but I said, yeah, sure, why not? And then like to say the rest is history, but it's like everything else. It's not what it's who sometimes. And a lot of people ask, like, you know, how do you get so many TV interviews? How do you do this? It isn't because I'm handsome or pretty, that's for sure. So it's, you know, I always tell people, anybody can do this. You know, I'm just a kid from Long Island who, you know, got a master's degree and, was a
You're academic.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, this isn't that difficult. I mean, you could, like everything else, if you want to do it, you got to learn how to do it and then just do it, right? This, like you're doing the podcast, right? This didn't start up overnight. It takes a lot of work. People don't realize how much work is involved in these things.
And how much research and stuff goes into it. But I want to get back to the things. You got promoted after like 5 or 6 years, right? You went to 7-3, then IAB, generic stuff. When did the fun stuff happen? Because I know you went to the fugitive division. I know you went all over. So when did the fun stuff happen after the first few years? How'd that process go?
I'll tell you, I really enjoyed being a cop in the Bronx. I learned a lot. And listen, the 47th precinct, we had lots of shootings and lots of homicides up there. We were one of the leading precincts up there at the time. People don't realize it, but that northern precinct, they experienced a lot of violence going back in the day. And I got involved. Well, I took the promotional exam. I got promoted. I think it was like 6 years and change. And Sean will tell you, right? So when you're getting promoted, right, they give you a list like, here's 15 places, pick one, right? I got my 16th choice.
Yeah, no, that's so, what I always say. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. It's all, you know, all the contracts come in, all the phone calls come in. So I had actually picked the 6-3 and the 8-3 as my first two choices, and they gave me the 7-3. So I figured they gave me the average. So, so I ended up in the 7-3, knowing exactly what I was getting involved with, right? Talk about baptism by fire. So we're talking 1999 too. So we're still talking about, a difficult time in New York City. And when I first got to the 7-3, we were talking about 88 homicides or so in a 1 square mile precinct. Oh. And talk about baptism by fire. So here I am, brand new sergeant, and I'm dealing with crime scenes like the first day when you're out there. So you learn quickly, you learn how to handle these things. And like everything else, it's like do or die, so to speak, where you have to do it and you got to learn how to do it. And, you know, you make mistakes, of course. You just hope that those mistakes aren't too costly. And then each crime scene, each incident gets easier and you get better at it. And that's kind of what led me into saying, you know what, I like to get to, you know, to the detective bureau at this point, because it was already too late to try to become a detective, right? Because I already got promoted. But I really started in the 7-3 saying, you know, I really like this investigative stuff. So after about 4 years in the 7-3, I said, I was going to try to get to the detective bureau. And anybody on the job knows when you go in front of the board, anything can happen. It's usually something you don't want. And it's like everything else, because I didn't have any help in anywhere. Right? You could just tell by my choices where I ended up, the 4-7, the 7-3. So I threw it out there, and you sit in front of a panel, and I'll never forget it, but the patrol captain turned to me and said, because everyone asked questions on this panel. So the patrol captain says, I only have one question. He's like, why would you want to leave the garden spot like the 7-3 precinct? And he says, you don't have to answer it. I just wanted to throw that out there. So, and they all told me too, in the break, you're going to go to IEB. It's as simple as that. Cause the IEB guy leaves the room and they turned to me and said, dude, you're going to the IEB. So, oh God. So, and I got lucky though. I ended up in the Queens IEB. So I didn't have to, commute to Manhattan yet or go back to the Bronx at that point. So, in most of the cases that you deal with in IB are just cops calling on cops. I mean, it's, people think, oh, the police don't police their own, whatever. What a joke that is.
Yeah, I know.
It's really
blue wall of silence.
Yeah, blue wall silence, my behind. Yeah. One thing I think the job does do is they make you paranoid, right? Like you're going to lose your job and if this, and all that other stuff. And I think that's what causes a lot of that. And I know we're going to sound biased, but actually the police department does a pretty good job trying to stomp things.
You're absolutely right. When they go after you, they go after you for a reason too. They usually get it right.
Yeah. I could tell you the cases that I had, none of them were saying like, oh, come on, this is nonsense. Right. They really only gave you something that had meat on it. Like there's something really bad going on here.
Yeah.
A lot of times too, you get these ex-girlfriends that, a call up. I tell these guys all the time, why do you tell, you know, why do you say these things? You know, it's going to come back and haunt you. And yeah. That's exactly what happens, right? So revenge becomes a motive behind some of this stuff. But, you know, like I said, it sounds biased, but, you know, the general public and the cop haters will never believe, oh, you're just, you know, bootlicking. You can't get through to people like that anyway, so I just ignore them.
Yeah, and that's why you're great, Joe, because you go on and you defend the cops. And in your book about the police-involved shootings, it's great. You know,
Yeah, well, like I said, when they need to be defended, I'll take the lumps. I'll go out there and I'll say, you know, this is, but you know what? When they don't do a good job or something really happens, I say that too. It's not like a one-sided thing. And no matter what I say, I always piss off half the group, right? If the cops did a good job, the anti-cop crowd is all over me. If I say the cops didn't do a good job, I got the cops sending me stuff like, hey, don't be that guy. You know, this, and I get emails from people like, oh, I can't believe you said that. For the other 100 times that I said the cops did a good job, did you send me an email saying, hey, thanks for backing us up? No, the only that one time you say something, they're like all over you, you know.
You can't win. Now, after the your stint in IAB, usually you get a gig. So did they offer you fugitive or cold case, or did you have to go another step before that?
No, I went to the squad before that. So I went to the 110 squad. I actually finally got what I wanted to. So I ended up in Corona. Never realizing that, because I was never in the precinct. I'll just tell you a quick funny story. So
yeah, I love this.
Talk about, you know, contracts that go in, right? So I get assigned to Queens Detective Squad, report to, you know, the 112. Was it the 112? I don't know where. Yeah, the boroughs are the 112, right? Mm-hmm. So report to the 112 for your assignment. So I drive to the 112. I park the car. I go up there. I speak to the lieutenant and everything. Oh, the chief is there. Everybody's like, oh, what happened? Boy, well, you're going to go to the 102 precinct. I'm like, okay. So I'm like, you know, there was no Google Waze, nothing, maps. So I'm like, where the hell is the 102, right? So I'm like, oh, yeah, great, you know. So I get my car. I drive over to the 102. I go into the squad. I see the lieutenant. I introduce myself. The phone rings. And they say, is, you know, Jack alone with you? Yeah, well, tell him he's been transferred to the 104 precinct. Okay. I get my car. I'm heading over to the 104. And my phone rings. Where are you now? I'm like, I said to the lieutenant, I'm just pulling over to the side of the road. When you guys decide to finally tell me where I'm going, I'm not driving all over Queens all day. So I went from, I got transferred from like the 102, the 104, and I ended up at the 110 all within like 5 hours. I guess all the phone calls were going in. I wanted the 102.
Wanted their spots, yeah.
You know what? It was fortunate because the 110 was a lot closer. I mean, the 104, if you asked me to find the 104 precinct today, I still couldn't find it. Wow. It's like tucked in away inside the community. I mean, it's like one of those places where it's like, but the 110, have you ever been to the 110?
I've been to 110, yeah.
The parking is the worst situation I think that you could ever find in a precinct.
Yeah, it's worse than the Fifth over there. It really is. It's worse than Chinatown over there. It really is.
Oh.
Do you have actually police cars parked in people's driveways? Because that's how screwy it is. And, you know, most of the people were okay with it, you know, the community. I mean, they understood that, you know, things would, every now and then you get somebody upset. But anyway, so I was in the 110 squad there. I learned a lot, like everything else. But it's like the first, like, homicide you get, the first shooting you get as a squad boss, you're like, freeze. You're like, what do I do? You know, it's not like I got to go and stand outside with my guys to make sure nobody gets in the crime scene like I did in Brooklyn, right? There's a whole nother, you know, aspect of it. So, you know, like everything else, you make some mistakes, and then you learn. And then where you really learn, I think what the NYPD does with the sergeants, and I think is a great idea, is like on Sundays you have the duty. So, meaning you cover like sometimes up to 5 or 6 precincts, and basically you know you're not going home because you've now, you know, 5 or 6 times the chances of something happening to you, but. It made you as a supervisor learn, first of all, where all the different precincts were. You get to see all the other detectives. You get to learn who everybody is, all the players are, so to speak. But you actually now are 5 and 6 times your crime scenes and your investigations, and you really get immersed into it. And I think that's a model that I think needs to be put out in some of the other big cities, too, if they're not doing that already.
Funny that you say that about Sundays, you know, like on patrol, too. If you're a sergeant on a Sunday, 4 to 12, you're the guy. You know, it's funny that you say that, Joe, about the squad. That's interesting, you know. Like,
Well, you think about it, it's baptism by fire, this job, right?
No, yeah, you're right. You're right. You're absolutely right. Yeah, a sergeant's a good spot because you learn it. You learn the job. You got to learn it, you know?
Yep, you certainly do. I always say the sergeants really run the job, right?
Yeah.
The best spot, as you know, is the lieutenant, right? I used to call him the elevator operator.
Yeah.
I don't want to do it, I push it up. I don't want to do it, I push it down. Captain, sergeant. So, but I'll tell you, I worked with some really good detective lieutenants. And, you know, talk about it. And what I liked about these guys too is that if you were willing to learn, and you would go in their office with a cup of coffee or something, and you sat down and you'd say, listen, this is what happened to me. How do I avoid to do that in the future? Or learning how to manage detectives over cops. Totally right. Two different things.
Oh, yeah.
You know, totally two different things. You have to learn quickly that you let detectives do their thing, so to speak, right? Quote, unquote, yeah. Do their thing. And that's how they work best under pressure. And that's how they go about doing their business. And it takes a bit to learn that.
Once you were as a DB sergeant now you knew you wanted to stay in that route. Did you go right next to cold case? Because a lot of your interviews, you said cold case was your favorite time on the job. So is that what you went next?
No, what happened was I was in school at the time too, when I was in the squad. I was working my master's degree. And we had the New York State said we were going to lose all of our credits for our courses. And at the time we had Chief Brown. And I guess, you fill out those things like, you know, what degrees you have, you know, when you get on the job, like where you live, where you work, what languages you speak, all that stuff, and degrees pop up. So I must have fell on a list that said, all right, this guy is, you know, going for his graduate degree. He's got this, he's got that, whatever. He's got squad experience. He's got all these things that they were looking for. So I get a call from an inspector. And he said, listen, the chief wants to know if, you know, we want you to go to the training unit. We got to get these, you know, courses up to speed. We got to get them credited. We got to do all this stuff. Homicide course, criminal investigations course, all these things. So I'm like, really not interested. Thanks. And like, good. We'll see you Monday. So here I am. So I end up going to Gold Street. And I spent a couple of years in Gold Street doing that. So we get everything accredited. We get the homicide course accredited. So when you know, I took that job serious for two reasons. One, I understood the value of getting an education and learning about things. We all know that training isn't the be-all and end-all, meaning that it's great to get training, but you have to experience it too. So when me and a couple of detectives, when we designed these courses and we came up with this stuff, we said, let's base it on reality, but let's make sure we also can teach them, you know, how to do the administrative stuff. So when they get there, they can write the reports, right? Because we know writing reports sometimes in the police department is tough. So, you know, because nobody really trains you. They think like, oh, you went to high school and you can write. Yeah. No.
Writing's hard. Not, yeah.
Yeah. Writing takes a lot. I still struggle with it every day. There's still some mm-hmm. words like effect and effect. I still couldn't tell you which one to use.
You mentioned that in the book, effect and effect. You made it easy. Those are the two words that was on the captain's test. The effect and effect. They, you know, the difference between the two. It was on the captain's test. Yeah. That's funny that you mentioned.
Yeah, there's always one. I always tell people this. You always have like your one word nemesis or two word nemesis.
Oh,
no matter how many times people tell you, you're still like, you know what, I don't get it. And well, I knew, you know, just a side note quick. I knew I had something really special with the book when New Jersey took it for police promotional exams for years.
Oh, that's awesome. Wow.
Yeah. So and what the council and everybody else that when they decided to do this, they said it was easy reading. It was basic to the point.
That's
it
great.
Wasn't, you know, there's no fluff in it. Right. I'm not putting war stories and cop stories and all that other stuff in there. It's just basic stuff. And, you know, the only complaint that people might have about the book was that I use a lot of acronyms. Right. So but, you know, from the police department, that's how we learned about things, right? Everything,
yeah.
ESU, EDP, right? Everything's an acronym.
Right.
So, you know, that's the way to do it. So I went there for a couple of years, and then I went to Chief Brown and said, okay, I spent the last, you know, 2 years or so doing this. We got it all up and good. I'd like to now go, you know, do something. I'll go back to the squad even. That's right. That's what I really wanted to do. And he said, no, listen, you know, you did a great job. I can't, you know, so you pick something and I'll tell you if it's doable or not. Wow. Right. So it's like one of those. You know, you shoot for the moon. If you get the stars, hey, listen, you're good. So I said, okay. And I had done my homework first. Right. So in Gold Street, the commanding officer of Cold Case is in Gold Street. And I was, you know, going down there. I was always talking to him because I was like, you know, like everybody else, planting the seed, so to speak. So I developed a good relationship with him. And I had asked him, I said, listen, is there a spot? Because I'm going to ask the chief to come. He says, great, love to have you.
Wow.
So he said, yeah, we got a spot. He says, you're going to the Bronx, though. I said, listen, I spent my first like 6 years in the Bronx. The Bronx doesn't scare me, no problem. You know, and anyway, I was going to Rivendale, you know, so it's like,
yeah, yeah. You know, oh, wow.
It's the nicest part of the Bronx.
Oh, it's in the 50?
Yeah, it's in the 50. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I went to the chief. I said, okay, I'd like to go to Cold Case. So he said, okay. So he walked me over to the lieutenant, the administrative lieutenant. And he said, put Joe in Cold Case. So he had said, well, we have to put him in Fugitive Enforcement Division because that's what Cold Case falls under. Because we only had, I think it was about, at the time, there was only 15 detectives left. He said, you know, and there was a sergeant and a lieutenant already. He said, if we put him in, quote unquote, Cold Case, everything's going to get thrown off and they're going to bounce it back because there's too much supervision. So he said, you know, do whatever you got to do with him. So he signs me to Fugitive Enforcement. So I went there and I saw at the time Chief O'Neill, who then became the police commissioner. He had already gotten the phone call from, you know, Chief Brown, told me exactly what was going on. He said he's going to be assigned to Fugitive, but he's going to Cold Case. And, you know, so I always respected Chief Brown for that. Not only did he say, you know, do this for me and I'll take care of you. And not only did he take care of me, but he made the phone calls to make sure it happened. By the time I got to Brooklyn that day, I knew I walked in. He said, the Chief O'Neill got up. He walked me out. We went right to the Cold Case squad and basically, you know, like pushed you back and said, here you go. See you later.
Wow. So, and here's my question with Cold Cases now. We all read books, podcasts, Cold Case is the hot thing. What makes you or a detective open up a case? Because most likely clues aren't coming in again. Like, hey, I know about a shooting from 85. What makes you pick and choose which cases you're going to reopen, look at and stuff?
Okay. It's basically two answers to that. First, you have, if you're going to go on your own and see if you can find a case for yourself. So at the time it was me and three detectives in Bronx Cold Case, Mark Tebbins, Tony Padilla, and Steve Berger. We'll talk about those guys another time.
Yeah, Tebbins. I met Tebbins once. Yeah.
Oh my God. Talk about great detectives. These guys, awesome. They were giants. They were giants, literally.
Yeah.
You know,
he was involved in the Wild Cowboys. The Wild Cowboys.
He was the Wild Cowboy. Yeah. They've written books about this guy.
Yeah. Gangbusters. You got to read that, Mike. Gangbusters.
Yeah. And the Wild Cowboy. There's a book, the Wild Cowboy.
Yeah. The Wild Cowboy. It's two different books. Yeah.
Yeah. And they also did an expose on him. And a couple of the people in Time magazine back in the 90s too.
Wow.
So, I mean, but you would never know it. He was a quiet, I used to call him the gentle giant. He was like 6'3", 6'4", like 250, but in good shape. Yeah. And then Tony was, it was over 6 foot. So Steve and I were always, we're tiny, right, compared to these guys. And it was funny because we would walk into a place and be like, listen, you either talk to us or you talk to them. And they would go like, look around you and go like, all right, we'll talk to you guys, you know. But getting back to how to pick a case. So if we went to a precinct to look for a case, we would look for what we refer to as solvability factors. What are our chances of solving this case based on certain things? So things like solvability factors would be DNA, of course. If there's fingerprints, potential eyewitnesses, all of those things would factor into it. Now, I know some police departments have like a matrix, right? They put numbers on, you know, DNA would be 8 points. We didn't do that. If we had a chance that there was DNA in it, then we would just take it because all the advances that were happening, it was a good opportunity. So that was the one way. So that was like a self-initiated. The second way that we come across a case is a request from a family member. We always preferred a family member because why? We want to get to know our victim. We're looking at cases, you know, 20, 30 years old. There's no way that we're going to find people to tell us, you know, who this person was, but the family. So the family was always a good spot, right? Because who was your victim doing that victimology? Who could, you know, want to hurt this person? Why did they do that, right? Trying to find the motive. And of course, that's an important thing. So that's how we did it. And then the third way actually, we would get things from other squads. And Jerry Giorgio, you might have heard of him. He was a pretty famous detective too. He was up in the 3-4 precinct. And because in the days, you know, we won't name names, but we had a big change in the detective bureau who was running it. We kind of lost our focus on certain things. And we went from, you know, trying to solve homicides and all this stuff to the minutiae, right? Everything became the grand larceny became now the homicide investigation, you know. And these guys would get, and girls would get like bogged down with this stuff. So they would call us up and say, listen, I got this great case. We kind of know what's going on, but I don't have the time to work on it anymore.
Wow.
Right. And they would dump these things on us. So they made us look good because they gave us stuff that was like, you know, three quarters of the way done that basically just had to finish, you know, bring it to the finish line. So Jerry Giorgio dropped the case on us that we ended up tying. His name was Angel Garrity. We tied him to 7 murders and 4 rapes.
Wow.
So
he was, you know, was in the DR? Was he hiding in the Dominican
Republic? Yeah, he fled to the Dominican Republic, and it took us a couple of years to get him out. Mm-hmm. So all of us had just about retired by the time he went to trial, but we all showed up in the Bronx courthouse. And we have a picture of us all together, all on our own time. You know, like I said, we were retired, but we had worked so hard on this case. Mark specifically, I mean, he got the case, and he talk about like pit bull mentality, right? I mean, he knew what we had, and, you know, following these things down. I mean, the frustration mounted too. I mean, you know, who didn't want to, you know, prosecute this case? Because what happened was it was a homicide in Manhattan, homicide in the Bronx, homicide in Queens. So now you have all these boroughs and all these jurisdictions. And after a while, you're kind of like, oh, God. So things kind of got a little hairy. But at the end of the day, Mark's perseverance was the thing that finally pushed this thing through.
And you mentioned in the book, too, that for cold cases, the prosecutor is tougher, right? They want more. Yeah.
Yeah, I refer to it as probable cause plus.
Yeah.
You know, that you don't get it. It's not like regular policing where you establish probable cause and you slap cuffs on people and you go to court. You know, you have a case that's 20 or 30 years old. The district attorney, if you make an arrest without their permission, they'll 343 it right there, right? Which is, you know, throw it out. And you don't want that either, because then double jeopardy comes in. You'll never be able to close that case. Wow. So working with the prosecutors I met a lot of good prosecutors. I've met a couple of bad ones too, just like cops, right? You got good ones and bad ones. And what I mean by bad ones, I'm not talking about corrupt. I'm talking about people who just like don't want to do their job.
Right.
You know, I know in this kind of language, when you say bad, people think corrupt.
Yeah,
you know?
Right. No, like, yeah.
You know, they don't want to, you know, go the extra mile. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
You just said the word frustration. As the CO, commanding officer of the cold case squad, what are the biggest hurdles? Because obviously you're going to say DNA and cameras. What causes a case to go cold? Is it just witnesses? Because like right now, there should never be a cold case with the Ring app, DNA and stuff. But what causes most cases to go cold?
Well, back in the day, most of the cases had a drug or a gang nexus, which you don't have any witnesses. You don't have anybody that wants to come forward. You get no information from the public because they're all scared to death, right? So that's you would walk into a squad room and you would see boxes of cases. And then every now and then you see these little folders, right? And you knew exactly what those cases were. They were all drug and gang cases. They had like 6 fives in them, right? Which is the DD5, which is the reports from your listeners there. So you had, you knew exactly what it was and you knew exactly why it was open because nobody wanted to help. That doesn't mean we didn't look into it, right? Because people sometimes change their mind 20 years later. Their kids have grown up. They moved away. Lots of different things change, you know, things happen, changes in relationships, right? Where the girlfriend didn't want to say anything, but now all of a sudden she, you know, the guy left her and he has kids with somebody else and now they're all pissed, right? Hell hath no fury. So those are the cases that you really look for, where you have that chance to be able to, we say, which had something with meat on it. You could sink your teeth into it. So yes, it would be great that every case had DNA, but if you remember going back in the 80s and stuff, specifically in the 70s, no, we didn't know about DNA. So anything that was vouched was put in plastic, and you ruined DNA samples, you know, blood. There was times when we opened up a box, you'd find a bloody shirt, not even in a security envelope. So you didn't know. So you always had to have gloves on. Yeah, you always had to have gloves on because you never know what the hell you were going to get into.
And clearance rates were higher, right, prior to DNA.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Clearance rates were much higher. Clearance rates continue to drop. And during the 2020, 2021, I think we're up 50, down to 54, which I think is the lowest on record, I think, since they started tracking them in the 60s. I mean, in the 60s, we're up in the 90s. Now we're up in, you know, 54%. They really dropped a lot the last couple of years, and there's reasons for it, right? So you had the violent protests going on, and now the pandemic, people didn't want to go knocking on people's doors, and you can't blame them. We didn't know what was going on, and we saw a huge drop. I'm hoping to see a rebound back up into the 60s over the next couple of years, but you know what, we might not find out, because the new crime stats, NIBRS, right? Oh my God, what a mess this is.
There's a professor, I don't know if you've ever heard of him, at Texas State, named Kim Rosmo. He wrote a good research paper, I think it was 2018, called The New Detective. He wrote it with John Eck, who's at the University of Cincinnati. He's a famous guy. And I recommend reading that. It's really good. He was a detective in Canada. He's big into geographical profiling and how to improve the investigative process. Now it's really good. And he talks about how he recommends having even a case that's not so old, a couple weeks old, having a team of detectives from another agency look it over, for a fresh set of eyes. And it's really good. I recommend it. Yeah.
That's my kind of like my thing in the cold case chapter, right? Fresh set of eyes, and I break it down.
Yeah, that's what I thought of right away.
Yeah, and like I said, so I'm glad to see those things stick with people, because that was right. The idea behind it, right? Well, a fresh set of eyes, so a phrase that would come up that I would break it down into an acronym and have people break these things down. And like yourself, saying, you know what, this point, so just that one little thing where you can read something and think about it and apply it to your job is a good, that kind of stuff makes me happy.
Yeah.
You're a big proponent about boots on the ground. Like really, forget about the cameras everywhere. You love the door-to-door old school detecting. In cold case, that must have been your dream job, because this is all, you're not going back to find video or social media. You were knocking on doors, finding into people. Was that like your bread and butter? Is that why it was your favorite time on the job?
Yeah, I like talking to people, and the guys that I work with love talking to people. And that's basically communication skills is like the number one thing that you need to have. And just to tell you a quick funny story, we went to the 405 precinct on an old case that was a mob related case. And we knocked on the door, and this little old lady answers the door. And we said the victim's name, or whatever, she stopped for a second. She goes, "You're still investigating them?" and we're like, "Yeah, unfortunately, whatever." So she's like, "Oh, come on in." So we're talking. And what happened was, at the time, her husband was the one who was the eyewitness. And, we're looking around the house. We don't hear any other noises. And we're kind of like, and she was an elderly woman. So I'm like, is anybody else that you think we might want to talk to, kind of thing. And she's like, "Sonny, you can say it." He goes, "My husband died a number of years ago. I know where you're headed with this." So she was pretty sharp. but she, she sat down with us at the table. We talked. But yes, communication skills, number one thing for policing, as far as I'm concerned. It can prevent you from getting yourself in trouble. It can prevent yourself. So people worry about CCRBs these days, executives, whatever. Communication skills are the whole thing. Tell people why you stopped them. Ask them to, go put the description back over the radio for the person who's upset that you stopped them because you think you profiled them, right? I mean, some of the simple things like that. But yes, learning how to talk to people, learning how to ask the right questions, watching people, how they react to certain things, all really important skills. And those are skills that you can learn. You get better at by doing it.
A fanboy question. Any noteworthy cases you ever worked on? Because I know New York City is, the five or six, Abe, the Second Avenue Deli, Sarah Fox, Eaton Pats, those are the famous ones.
Sarah Fox.
Yeah. Did you ever work on any cold cases that we know about?
Yeah, we worked the Sarah Fox case. We also worked the Baby Hope case, who just a couple of years ago.
Oh, yeah. So, 3-4, yeah, right? Baby Hope?
Yep. Yeah. And once again, Jerry Giorgio was his case. So, I always said all roads lead to Jerry, I used to say, in cold case, because all the major cases that we had up there, or even Northern Manhattan, they all had Jerry Giorgio's imprint on it.
He couldn't solve anything, right? No, I'm just kidding.
well, like everything else, remember the 3-4 back in the day, my God, it was like, it was like a war zone. Now you go up there, there's like, cupcake stores on every corner.
Right.
Yeah, Baby Hope was a case where a lot of people don't know. I can talk about it now because they made the arrest and the conviction.
Yeah, please do.
But we had actually cameras set up at the cemetery because on anniversary dates, things would show up at the gravesite. Now, the gravesite was not in the directory. meaning you couldn't go into the thing and say, oh, could you tell me what section, plot, lumber? So you had to know it was there. And you know, we ended up, after a while, we ended up figuring out that it was a couple of cops from the 3-4 that would go up there on, you know, Christmas and the anniversary dates. The one we were really keying in on was the dates when she was found, right? Things were showing up there. So, you know, we kind of dismissed that right away once we realized it was cops just coming, laying flowers and teddy bears and those kind of things. But it just goes to show you, the reason why I always tell that story is to go the length that we will go to try to discover a lead or somebody. I think the general public really needs to hear that, because
it's awesome.
We go way above it. What I always say is the cold case investigator is the last liaison between the public and the police. And the police always are talking about, oh, we need to improve community relations, we need to do this, which caused me to write an op-ed that ended up going on this Police Insight website and say, we always are stretching to try to find, you know, the community stuff. But meanwhile, we have things right here that we can do immediately, including, you know, start getting back involved in cold cases. There's big changes coming for police departments. I don't know if they're ready for it yet with cold cases, but two new laws have passed in the last couple of months. You had the Homicide Victims Rights Act signed in the federal law, and the other day just the Help Find the Missing Act. So those two laws are going to really change how cold cases are handled. And I'm writing a new textbook currently right now that's actually due in February on cold cases. And let me tell you something. I break down the laws just like we were talking about before, Sean, right, with the book. So we're breaking down these laws and telling the chiefs and the executives or police commissioners, you know, with the different names throughout the country, what they're really in store for. And I can tell you, they're not ready for it. Because when I'm reading this, I'm going, how is even New York City going to handle this? Major cities are going to have huge problems, specifically with the Help Find the Missing Act, because it is it adds a whole nother level to this thing. So they better be prepared.
Wow.
You love the cold case so much. When was it time to put a bow on your career and wrap it up? When did you know, and this is time, and why?
Well, because like everything else, I wasn't happy with the way things were getting run in regards to not my unit, but above us, right? So like I said, we won't name names, but
3-4 connection?
things got a little dicey for me at the end, because like everything else, I'm not I don't like prepare for things. So like when we do like stuff like this, right, I prefer doing interviews without knowing any questions or anything like that, because I want to be just as surprised as the listener what comes out of my mouth. And I kind of like, it didn't really matter if you were a 3-star chief or not. If you said something to me, whatever, I would always say something back, kind of thing. It kind of fell out of favor with that. But, you know, I also then got transferred out the last couple of months, too, probably because of that. So I ended up in a good spot, but I ended up like directly underneath the supervision, which was probably another thing. Right. So I ended up in Crime Stoppers for the last couple of months. And I tell you, talk about another great unit and another valuable asset that the police department has. And I always like to say I put an imprint on that, too. We changed a lot of things. We got a new bus. We got rid of the bus and we got, you know, smaller car, you know, smaller vans, and made the thing mobile and to do that kind of thing. I like to take some credit for some of the new things that have happened over the few years. But you know, someone's got to pat you on the back. But yeah. I ended up leaving shortly, you know, after that, a couple of months, and then like I was gone. I had enough, right?
Yeah, it's great. You left in 20. You left a young man, healthy man. That's good. That's the good way to do it.
Yeah,
well, you left the job. You know, I left loving the job. That's the way to do it.
Right. I liked the job. I just didn't like the conditions I had to work under.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That's always. But it doesn't matter if you're in the police department or you're working for the major corporation. If the boss makes or breaks people, and if people just learn that if you just leave people alone, so to speak, they will do great things. But if you are going to micromanage people, I am not the kind of person that needs to be micromanaged. You don't even have to show up. I will be on time every day. I will leave exactly when I am supposed to leave, and I'll do everything I'm supposed to do within that 8 hours or so to do it. I'm not the guy. You know, we all know there's plenty of people on our job that you got to be standing on top of them, because you look left, you look right, they're gone. So, you know, and that kind of supervision didn't work with me.
Yeah.
Retirement now, professor, writing books, but you're also all over the news. And I want to talk current affairs with the Idaho case, the Idaho 4. We were obsessed with it like everyone else. It just had so many things. And the police did a fascinating job and a great job by not just giving into the web sleuths and everyone else. Like, we need more info. They're not doing anything. Initially, like everyone else, we're all into it. What were your initial thoughts and theories on it?
Well, if you look at the interviews I did on this, right, I did a number of them. I did Newsweek. I did a couple of big ones, News Nation. And to toot my own horn, there's a video that I think most people should watch on the Law and Crime Network about 2 days before this thing happened.
No, Joe, you're right. You're right. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Joe, but I'm so excited. Yeah, exactly. And I just want to say one thing. I listened to a couple other podcasts. One is, I'm not going to mention any names, but one is a guy who was on the job too. And he's a really good guy, but he said 2 days before, he said, no, I disagree with Jack Alone. I don't think they have a suspect, but you had said, I think they're zeroing in on somebody. And I said to Mike, I said, oh my God, this is perfect timing to have Sergeant Jack Alone on. I just wanted to go, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I had to say.
No, no problem. Thanks.
Yeah, you were right.
No, listen. Well, I kind of felt I was right for several reasons. One, the chief had done an interview the day before with the press. And here he is, he's sitting back in his chair.
He was happy.
Yep. Yeah. He had a calm look on his face. And I said, that is a man who has a guy on the radar.
Yep.
So when I was on the TV, I said, you know, listen, they have a suspect of suspects. I always use those two words, right, too, because you never know if there's more than one person. But I said, he had a suspect. And I, if you watch it, even the host was like, really? Like, you know, kind of, they were, and they actually even wrote that in the thing. They had suspects. Ex-sergeant says this and that.
I listened to what you had said. I knew you were right. You know.
Listen, were there times where I said I was concerned about how things go? Yeah, I was concerned about a couple of things, but those are administrative stuff specifically.
But you never criticized the cops on that case. You knew. And I'm not trying to listen. I'm not going to have you for a class. I don't need an A. But I'm just saying you knew. No, and I told Mike too. I said he's the perfect guest. You know, he knew. You know, so
thanks. Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Like I said, there was a couple of administrative things that I saw that I didn't like. But like everything else, at the end of the day, it's about the value of the quality of the investigation and not the quantity of it. And it's about teamwork. It's about collaboration. It's about the local, state, and feds working together. Right? Not like the garbage you see on television where the cops and the feds are always fighting. I always tell people, I'm like, is the exact opposite. If the feds showed up in my office and they came in a couple of times, they say, hey, listen, we want this case. Who's got the gift wrapping? Let's put it together.
Right.
Because like cold case especially, who cares who solves it, right?
Yeah.
If my job is to get this case closed, and that the only way it gets closed is through an arrest or exceptional means, right? So exceptional means, for those who might not know, that you have a reason, you have probable cause, but just some reason out of your control that you can't make the arrest, right? So the guy's in federal custody, you can't talk to him. He's in Cuba, you know, somewhere we don't have extradition. So that's how that works. But at the end of the day, your job is to close cases and provide a sense of closure and justice for the family. So who cares who solves this case? You know, and that became a thing with some, you know, ex-FBI agents. Oh, this is an FBI case. And I kind of set that straight too in a couple of things. Like, there is no federal nexus.
Yeah, no, it's jurisdiction. It's like it's a local case. It's funny. I hate to, you know, with Fry, I think Fry is like the new Churchill. You know, like the guy's unbelievable. He was. The latest thing I saw was him, and I hadn't seen this before. He was sitting in his office, and in the background, you could see the FBI National Academy yellow brick. So he's been to that academy. They play him off as like this hillbilly who doesn't really know what he's doing, but he's good. He's really good. He's great.
And then if you remember too, there was a lot of outcry about the charge of the detective in charge or the investigator in charge only
2 years.
Had like a year or so. Yeah, 2 years.
Right.
And I said, if you caught that interview, I said, we're talking about an entire state that had 41 homicides in the entire state. Yeah. You're not going to find a detective that has lots of experience, right? Yeah. This is it. Baptism by fire. This is how you learn. And, you know, this guy now is going to be a rock star in the state of Idaho.
Yep.
And he'll be teaching at the academy. I mean, this is awesome, because we know as cops, right, how things go and how things work. And when you have somebody that did something like this, this is like phenomenal beyond belief. Oh,
it's tremendous. It gives me the chills thinking about it, talking about it.
Right.
And I love how Fry was so classy that he thanked the media. Like, he could have been a guy who said, oh, you doubted me, but he's just unbelievable. He's unbelievable.
Yep.
He's a great representation of the police, you know,
And I like when they do the presser, like how everybody was squared away too, right?
The Mountie coming in
with his hat on, you know.
Yeah, they were great.
And the whole thing, like, we've kind of gotten away with that from the NYPD, right? Everyone's got beards and like, you know.
Joe, I'm with you on the beards thing. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievably bad, you know, like.
Everybody's wearing something different. It's just.
Yeah, we used to have the regular trousers. Now they have the pants with the pot, you know, like, but nobody wears the tie, you know?
Yeah. Well, like I said, I'll call me old school, call me old fashioned, whatever. I still think no beards. One uniform for everybody, you know, that kind of thing. When you kind of get away from that, it looks like different police departments. And of course, some people, you know, don't take care of their stuff, and they end up looking bad. And we know that how good first impressions are. And that's to me is where you look at those representatives from out there in Idaho, there wasn't one thing in there that was out of place on those guys.
Yeah.
They were. And that exudes professionalism, right? So when you look about what's the quality of this investigation? I was just look at the people who were running it. They were like squared away, I's dotted, T's crossed. That's the kind of thing that you want to have represent you visually, because it all then trickles down after that.
A couple of weeks ago, we had no idea what was going on with the case. We had no suspects. Everyone had their own theories. And you were very vocal at saying that they shouldn't offer reward. It would show desperation. Why would that be? Because Sean and I disagreed on that. Because I'm like, let's get every tip in. And you're like, no, we're not. Why were you so vocal on that?
No, you were right about that, Joe. Unbelievable.
Yeah. It got to a point where you say to yourself, it's too late, right? So, and here's where some experience kicks in, right? So from working in the squad, working in cold case, and then of course at the end with Crime Stoppers, and now you can see where all that ties in. So I know how the system works. And the whole thing about the reward coming too late, because it would have shown that desperation. And the only reason why I had said that is because the media was like relentless, and social media was just really awful about, you know, how they were treating the people involved in this stuff. Right?
Well, they were vile.
Some of the things. I take some of that. I took some of that stuff too. I got people sending me stuff and saying that, you too don't know what the hell you're talking about, right? And I'm like, okay, whatever. I don't care. You know, listen, when you've been a city cop for over 20 years, and you worked in some of these when people don't realize, like when they say, oh, it wasn't bad as the 90s. I was a cop in the 90s, right?
Yeah.
You weren't even born yet. So you get this hard shell about you and especially working with cops, right? I mean, you better have a turtle back, because they are relentless. Absolutely relentless. Some of them are actually the funniest people you'll ever meet.
I always say that too. Yeah. The cops are the funniest people. Yeah.
You know, so, at that point, I thought it was not a good idea. I also did say, too, the time to come out with the reward is when they should have put that vehicle out much sooner. Right. They had that white Elantra from the beginning, and they held on to it, I thought, a little too late, because I think this would have cleared up a little bit earlier. But you know what? They ran it. They did their thing. And I was talking about the DNA from the beginning too, about how the mixtures and all these things take time, and they're going to have to get exemplars. They're going to have to do all this stuff. And I go, this isn't like, this isn't CSI Miami, where they close a quadruple homicide with 35 minutes and three commercials. You know, I mean, this is
even in New York City, that would be tough.
Yeah. And listen, we had a couple of quads in cold case that are still open. Right. So, I mean, one thing I'll tell you about cold cases too. I was probably, if I had to put a percentage number, I would say more than 75% of the time we know who the killer is, but we're missing the evidence. And I had come out publicly against a few in the true crime community for that reason too. Like, you know, yeah, you guys have all solved this case, right? But you don't have to go to court. You don't have to
put it together.
You don't, Yeah, you don't have to have evidence. You can do whatever you want. Now you have the one lady's getting sued by the professor.
Oh, I know. I hope she wins too. She's a crazy nut. That lady. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, it doesn't look good for her, right? Because the first bullet in their press conference the day or two before the arrest, they said that this professor had nothing to do with it.
Yeah. And she kept going on and on.
Yeah, doubled down and tripled down in certain things. But, you know, and I try to explain, you can't accuse people. You're going to, first of all, you're going to get yourself sued. But second of all, you can get somebody hurt, right? Yeah. So I know, I think it's the ex-boyfriend of one of the girls.
Right.
Boyfriend of the girl, excuse me. And he's now been publicly coming out on Twitter saying, I guess, you know, I'll get everybody's apologies. I guess I'll get it either in writing or verbally. Yeah. You know? I'm like, yeah, don't hold your breath, kid. But they dragged a couple of people through the mud. And think about this. We as cops know that there are people out there that will try to take revenge, right? Because now they want to get their name in the paper for doing this. And it's a dangerous game that people play with the social media stuff. Listen, the overwhelming majority of the true crime people, good people, they want to, you know, it's not having fun, right? It's not, we don't want to say having fun, but they enjoy doing what they're doing. They like the thrill of the chase. They like to do the armchair, the check the stuff. I don't have a problem with that. I only have a problem with it when they start naming names and coming up with these wild theories, right? You know, it was Professor Plum in the library with the candlestick, you know.
Making up the scream. And then the guy who made up the scream. That was, I watched that one too. I was like, oh my God, that's crazy.
Well, there's a couple other things that are floating. We won't name it because we don't want to, you know, add to this thing. But yeah, the scream was one of them. And there's a new one coming out now too. So.
Oh God!
About something else. Yeah. After all, you just kind of shake. They haven't give up, right? They have an arrest, but now it's not the guy, right? Now the conspiracy theorists are really. Oh my God.
Joe, what do you think? How big do you think he had gotten a seatbelt summons in August? How big do you think that played in the tracking the car down? You think that you know, we're only speculating.
Right. Well, I mean, I think like everything else, we know how investigations go, right? You always look for that one break. You always look for that one thing.
That looks pretty good.
Yeah, it looks pretty good. And not only that, but if you remember in that, even in that same interview, I kind of said, you know, they go start off with a close circle of friends and then just go out and see what other, you know, maybe there's another school there and, you know, that kind of whole thing, right? So we learn as cops, right? Start off with the throw the pebble in the lake thing and then let the thing go out, you know, start local and then start going your way out. Now, one thing that nobody's really talking about is, what is there or was there surveillance video at the apartment complex that this guy lives in? Because that could be like really, really good, right? If we have a picture of him coming, a video of him coming out of the car, because you know as well as I do, there's no way he wasn't soaked in blood and all that other stuff that came out.
Yeah. Oof.
We had you on for an hour, and I wanted to talk about the current state of policing, crime trends. So you're gonna have to come on again and do it, and we're gonna do it live. We have a bar in the city that gives us a private floor. But I want to talk more about your writing and your books. We have a lot of authors on. You're writing the books. You have a writing process. Is it every day, research factors, and do you enjoy that whole process?
I really enjoy it. I have like my own little thing. I always say I have a form of ADHD, right? So I have to do this in spurts. So I will sit down and write 20 pages in one day, and then I won't touch it for like 2 or 3 days, that kind of thing. But now I work good with deadlines. So I have a deadline for this new book. So as soon as we're done now, I have all my computers set up. I'm ready to go. And that's because I work on under the – I do best under pressure.
Do me a favor, plug all your books, what they're about, why people should grab them and stuff.
Well, the one book I have is the Criminal Investigative Function, A Guide to New Investigators. I just sent the fourth edition now. Yep, there's the third edition.
Oh, you got the fourth edition's out?
The fourth edition. Yeah, it's not out yet. It was sent to the publisher. So here I am, right? So this summer I spent editing the fourth edition and writing a new book, and the new book will be on cold cases. It doesn't have a name yet because I have no control over that, right? The publisher has all that control. Even when I write op-eds, I've written numerous ones. They appeared in Daily News, New York Post, USA Today. I've done a lot of that too. And I always tell people, if you're interested in getting involved in doing interviews and stuff for the media, write op-eds, get yourself involved in certain things. Go back to school, get your master's degree, teach, because that, I'll tell you something, the draw of John Jay College for media people is about 90% of the reason why people want to talk to me, right? Being a cop, 10%. They don't really care about that, because The media is interested in people who they believe are experts based on, you know, academic stuff. Yeah. So, it, you know, and I always tell people, how do you do it? That's, we could do a whole podcast show on that, because I could teach any cop how to do this if they really want to. Because, like, you know as well as I do, there are cops out there that say, what the hell does this guy know? And blah, 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 blah. Was I the most experienced guy in the department? Hell no. Were there guys out there and girls out there with a lot more experience than I did? Yeah. I just happened to be right place at the right time, but I also learned how to work the system in my favor and how to do this. Anybody can do it.
You also need we need guys who speak in our favor too, though. You know, like everybody's speaking against the cops. You need educated guys who are speaking for us too. So that's, well, you know,
yeah, that's part of it. We, and also, and like I said, I always say I try to be fair, right? So when they do good, I'm there to do this. Say, listen, nope. And if you go online and see some of the videos I had to do during the real height of the anti-cop movement, where I'm on CNN and some of these other tough things trying to handle this stuff. There's actually a favorite one I have on an MSNBC where I kind of arguing with the guy, and it's just, if you know what you're talking about, you know what you're, and you know exactly what you, where you come from, you know, that experience is invaluable, kind of thing.
The media push of anti-police and all that, the defunding stuff, you teach at John Jay, which has always been a police stronghold. It's always, you know, it's a grooming mm-hmm. thing for law enforcement stuff. Have you noticed maybe an uptick in students questioning police stuff or looking at it that way? And is that a bad thing?
No, I don't really see any more of my students question policing than before. I don't. The fact that even through all of this anti-cop movement and anti-cop rhetoric and all this other nonsense that you deal with, they still want to be cops, these kids. So yeah. To me, I think that's a stronger testament of the fact that people are learning to tune out certain voices. And now here we are, you know, 2 years into this, and it's been disastrous everywhere, this defund the police movement, right? Minneapolis is trying to hire cops. All the places that were ground zero for these things are all struggling. Washington, D.C. is now opening a new precinct after they closed things down years ago. So, yeah. But they never spoke to people like myself or others that would tell you, what are you doing, right? I mean, like, they only went, you know, the politicians pandered to the activists in this, and never consulted anybody else, kind of, because of the fact that this was a vote getter. And now that it is a detractor, right? I mean, we saw in New York State, we saw lots of change in voter habits. You see how fast it's like they're going to try to distance themselves. But I can tell them one thing, the internet is forever. And this isn't like 20 years ago where you could say something and never have to worry about it. These things will haunt them to the either they change or they get thrown out of office, and that's what they're worried about.
Ready to finish up with some quick hit questions?
Sure. Okay.
Worst holiday meal you ever had in an RMP?
I had a turkey sandwich on Thanksgiving that I ended up getting food poisoning for the next 5 days afterwards. We got it from a bodega, but I think it was Thanksgiving. I was working, let's do it, and I paid for it.
Most famous person you ever met while working?
I'll say Walter Cronkite. Yeah, there was a number of people.
That's a good
Walter
one.
Cronkite, I have a picture. I actually took a picture with the sergeant at the time and another cop. We were on a detail in Manhattan, and we noticed. But there's been a number of them, but I would say Walter Cronkite.
Favorite police show or movie?
Favorite police show, Barney Miller.
Oh, yeah.
Probably the most legitimate detective show. Yeah. I mean, characters, you know, the kind of characters. I mean, that's exactly what you got. But if I had to pick a more serious one, I'd probably say the first season or two of NYPD Blue.
Last show you binged watched. Does that be a cop show? Last show you binged watched.
Mandalorian.
Good?
The Mandalorian. Yep. I enjoyed that. That was good. I like all that Star Wars, Marvel stuff. I carried that over from the kid. So, yep, I still watch that stuff today.
And last one for me. You and I at a bar in New York City. Who's the coolest person in your phone that if you texted them, they would text you back?
Other than Mike Stefanski.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I have one for you. I have I'm very good friends, acquaintance with his name is Carol Cooley. Now you say, who's Carol Cooley? He was the detective that arrested Ernesto Miranda. back in 1966. Oh, yeah,
yeah, the picture's in the book. The picture's in the book,
yep,
right?
Yeah, the picture's in the book. I speak to Carol. Actually, I just got a Happy New Year card from him in the mail the other day. Yeah, Carol is, he's one of the living legends in this country. He's fallen on some health hard times, whatever, but so in regards to policing and stuff like that, he's probably the coolest.
That's a good answer.
Didn't Miranda get killed in prison? He got killed in prison, I think, right?
No, he got killed when he was released. Yeah, he got into a bar fight, and the guy stabbed him to death, and nobody wanted to talk to the police because of the Miranda warnings.
Right, so, yeah.
There's an irony for you, right?
Sean, you want to do any finish-up questions before we do the plugs?
No, I think I'm good. It was great talking to you, Joe, and we really appreciate it. Well, it was perfect timing, too. It was perfect timing with the arrest of the Idaho guy, and it was great.
Yeah, no, it's good. Like I said, I had a busy media week, and then this week I think it'll be the same thing once this guy gets back to Idaho. And people, just another quick thing on this Idaho thing. You know, people don't realize that the cops in, you know, the warden or whatever in Pennsylvania, they can't wait to get rid of this guy.
Oh, I know,
He's a liability. God forbid he kills himself or something. Or kills himself. Let's put it this way. If it was up to me, I'd have the judge on the tarmac at 9:01 this morning. Yeah.
Do all the plugs. Give you plugs for your Twitter, your Instagram, your website, where everyone can get books. Just give the full plug.
Okay. Yep. Website is josephjackalone.com, and that's with an A, right? GIACALONE.com. My Twitter is at Joe Jackalone. My Facebook page is Joseph L. Jackalone. And I have to do all these variations because if you watch the Irishman, the guy, last guy seen with Jimmy Hoffa is Joseph Jackalone, right? The son of Anthony Jackalone, the head of the crime family, which I get all the time. Actually, they always put my picture with Anthony Jackalone on there. Say the son of is now a cop. You know, I get this all the time. I have to tell them to take it down, right? So I just stopped trying to do it because I get phone calls from people, you know, media people. Oh, I'd like to talk to you about the Irishman, you know.
Listen,
I don't know any Irishmen.
Listen, this was an absolute blast, and I mean this. We do it from in a bar in the city, so if you're ever around, we'll definitely do it live. We'll bring down Giorgio, talk about Baby Hope, do another one live, and I want to talk about the current state of policing, crime stats, trends you're seeing, gun violence. We'll definitely do it again.
Sounds like a plan. Yeah, we'll let you know when we can try to pull that off.
This was a blast. Good luck with your book, and we'll keep in touch.
Thanks, fellas. Had a great time.
See you guys later. Bye-bye.